All right, thanks. So this is, of course, something which was, like the others, covered at the fifth PQC standardization conference. And my objective here, since there's more time, is to go into more detail. So this will be a more detailed overview and updates of what's going on with MCLEES. We have the same tagline as always: classic MCLEES, conservative code-based cryptography. And in a little more detail than that, this is the paramount conservative code-based encryption scheme. In fact, even beyond code-based, it is the conservative public key encryption scheme. Now, this is something where people look at this and say, wait a minute, is MCLEES actually conservative? I mean, if you go back through the literature, there's lots of papers which are saying things like, here's some security issues with MCLEES. For instance, in 1999, Hall, Goldberg, and Schneier had a paper on reaction attacks. And that is breaking some security properties for MCLEES-based systems. It's saying you can take a MCLEES ciphertext and then modify the ciphertext a little bit, see what the reaction is of the receiver. So it's a chosen ciphertext attack, looks at the reaction to some modified ciphertext. And then, depending on the pattern of what successfully decrypts and what doesn't, it figures out the original plain text. And then in this 99 paper, they say, well, this means that MCLEES is just not ready. I mean, any real-world application, you have to worry about somebody who's doing that. Two more examples: NTS Chem and Paloma. These are MCLEES-based systems which claimed to have security against chosen ciphertext attacks, and well, those claims were broken by various classic MCLEES team members. But still, why are we talking about MCLEES as conservative if there's these papers which are breaking security properties for MCLEES-based systems? Well, the answer to that is we're being super careful to rely on the absolute simplest security property you can imagine for any sort of public key encryption, confidentiality kind of system, which is one-wayness. So we are just relying on the assumption that MCLEES is one way. So this is, there's no chosen ciphertext. There's nothing that an attacker can do to interact, choose what you're going to respond to. In fact, there's no use of your decryption algorithm in this definition of one-wayness. It's simply you take a plain text and you encrypt the plain text, and then the attacker is trying to figure out from the ciphertext what the plain text was. And it's not like two plain text chosen by the attacker, and then the attacker's trying to distinguish, did you encrypt this one or did you encrypt that one? It's not a distinguishing thing. It's just you choose a completely secret random plain text, as random as possible, so uniformly distributed across all possible plain text. And then the attacker sees the result and is trying to search for your plain text. And well, can they do that? They get one chance to try to guess what your plain text is, computing something based on your ciphertext and your public key. So this is really the simplest possible security property, and this is also what MCLEES was trying to achieve in his original paper, and this is what lots of papers have been studying. I'll get back to that later. Now, of course, applications want to have more than this, and we are providing more than this. We're relying on just one-wayness, but we're providing something much more powerful, which is an in-CCA2 chem. Now, I want to go carefully through this because, like, how are we relying on only this minimum property but providing much more? And I'm going to do this top-down, starting from this objective of providing an in-CCA2 chem and then working down to how do we relate that to one-wayness for MCLEES. This is something where we have a dedicated document all about this, the Classic MCLEES Security Guide. And this is something where, I'm doing it in a different order. That one is sort of starting from MCLEES and then working towards classic MCLEES. I'll do it sort of backwards of start from the objective and then work down to what MCLEES is. So this goal of an in-CCA2 chem, this is something much more powerful. The attacker is allowed to try choosing other ciphertexts and seeing what your reaction is to that, and not just whether you decapsulate them or not, but what is your output for any other ciphertext. And then the attacker is just faced with a distinguishing problem. Can they distinguish your chem session key from a uniform random key? So this is much more powerful than the one-way search problem that I was mentioning before. But okay, this is getting towards what applications need. I should be clear here that applications typically actually need more than this. I mean, normally an application is trying to encrypt a user message. So they want a public key encryption scheme, a PKE, not just a chem. But the reason that we're happy focusing on a chem is that, first of all, we can translate a chem into a PKE using a generic transformation. This is the chem plus dem construction of a PKE. So concretely, you have your chem, and you use that to make a session key. And then you say, okay, I've now plugged in your favorite authenticated encryption mechanism, maybe AES-GCM. And then assuming AES-GCM is secure, you use that to encrypt your message using the key coming out of your chem, and that gives you a public key encryption scheme. If your chem is in CCA2 secure, then you have a PKE, which is in CCA2 secure, assuming that that AES-GCM is secure. And okay, so this means that even though we're thinking about a chem as, in the end, encrypting a user message because there's this transformation from a chem to a PKE, we have the simplicity of just designing a chem where we don't have to worry about a user message coming in as input. This is something which goes back to Victor Shoup. He was looking at, for example, RSA. People were getting in all sorts of trouble with trying to use RSA to encrypt a user message by pad the user message with some random padding, PKCS, and so on. And that is something which often ends up being broken by chosen ciphertext attacks. And, well, he was saying, you know, it's easier. He introduced the chem concept and this decomposition and said it's easier to just design a chem. For example, RSA chem is just you encrypt a random number, and then your session key is a hash of that random number. There's still things that can go wrong here, as illustrated by various attacks like Rocca, but it's simpler to not have to deal with a user message. It simplifies your chem design process. And so that's good. That means that we can focus on a simpler task, more chance of getting that right. There's other examples of these transformations, like Victor went on to write an ISO standard for public key encryption where you can see all these different key encapsulation mechanisms, which are definitely simpler than a PKE would be. And so he's taking advantage of this decomposition. But he's also saying, you know, applications actually typically want to do more than even a PKE. For example, applications often want to tie the public key encryption to a user identity. So what is this user identity? Well, it depends on the application. Sometimes it's a public key or a prefix of a public key or a hash of a public key. Sometimes it's in a different space. But often applications, whatever the user identities are, often applications want to say, I want to have my public key encryption tied to this user identity. So you cannot reuse a ciphertext for some other user identity. Now, Victor said in this ISO standard with all these chems, you could have your chems taking care of this, have this user identity as something else, an input for the chem, and the chem is responsible for binding what it's doing to that identity. But he says it's easier to do that separately, and that keeps the chem simpler, which makes the chem design easier. We've seen again and again that people who get distracted by stretch goals for chems, well, lots of chems have been broken. We want to focus on this clear goal of in CCA2, which is good enough because of all these transformations that are well known. You can convert in CCA2 chems into what applications need. All right, so that's the first step in being clear about what the goal is and choosing this goal, which is the right goal. It's the simplest thing that lets us easily build what applications want. But, well, we have to do more work beyond this to relate in CCA2 chem to internally to how do we get down to one-wayness of McLees. Well, the first step is to say, all right, choose a good hash function. And here we choose SHAKE256 with whatever output length is appropriate. And the idea here is that any attack against the chem using SHAKE256 hopefully is going to be an attack that works against any function, any hash function that you plug in. The best attacks you can do using SHAKE256 are going to be attacks where any hash function you can evaluate, you just change SHAKE256 to that function. And in other words, the hope is that SHAKE256, that this chem with SHAKE256 is going to have the same in CCA2 security level as its QROM in CCA2 security level. So a QROM in CCA2 attack is an attack which is allowed to access a hash function even in superposition. The attacker maybe has a quantum computer, but it's an attack that works for any hash function. And then, okay, this is not a theorem, and I mean, it relies on, well, hopefully SHAKE256 is secure, but this is a very conservative choice that's survived a lot of analysis, and so we're comfortable with that. And that lets us focus on the QROM in CCA2 property. And then that's something which reduces to the underlying public key encryption scheme. There's a PKE inside classic MCLEIS, which is getting towards the original MCLEIS system. And this is something which we use an FO type transform to build the chem out of that PKE. And QROM NCCA2 is something any QROM NCCA2 attack is guaranteed to be approximately as difficult as a one-wayness attack against the underlying PKE. And this is a general fact. The fact that this is a like this tight reduction, the fact that you have this tight relationship between QROM NCCA2 security and one-wayness of the underlying PKE, that's a general theorem about deterministic correct public key encryption schemes when you convert them to chems in a standard way. All right, so I said this is getting close to original MCLEIS, but it's not exactly the same. For example, we're using an optimization from Niederreiter to have smaller ciphertext. And you have to check that every change you're making, is that something which could reduce security? And so, okay, that's what section 4 of the security guide is about, is saying that the one-wayness of this public key encryption scheme inside the chem, the one-wayness of that follows from the one-wayness, tightly from the one-wayness of the original MCLEIS public key encryption scheme. And so that really closes the loop. At that point, we've got NCCA2 chem, these stages get us down to one-wayness of the MCLEIS public key encryption scheme. And then the original cryptanalysis, well, that's section 3 of the security guide, is going through how fast are the one-wayness attacks against MCLEIS. Having this structure for the analysis allows us to say, all right, what are the possible risks? Well, the structure here is telling you, here's all the possible things that can go wrong are some hash function disaster with SHA-256, or some mistake in these tight reductions, so we check those very carefully, or some better one-wayness attack against MCLEIS. And that's it. The whole name of classic MCLEIS is referring to the security that MCLEIS was aiming for. That's the security that we're relying on. All right. A picture that we like to draw is the following. This graph is on the horizontal axis showing years from 1978 until now. And every dot there is a paper where somebody is trying to break the one-wayness of the MCLEIS system. Now, the vertical axis is the asymptotic security level. So what does this mean? If you have some algorithm where you have like n squared cost for the algorithm and you speed it up to, say, n log n or just n, or, well, the point is if you have n squared going down to n and maybe some log factors and other things which are below something which is n to some constant, that's a change from 2 to 1 in the main exponent, n squared down to n to the 1. And that would be the vertical axis here, would go 2 down to 1, which is, for MCLEIS, not what we see. What we see is it's just constant. No matter how much you zoom in, this asymptotic security level, it really is exactly a constant there. So that's not saying that the papers have done nothing, but it's saying that none of the improvements are making a difference in the asymptotic exponent. So if you have your key size going to infinity, then the asymptotic improvement in these attacks is, well, converging to 0%. Now, the fact that the graph is flat like this might make it seem like this is not a very useful graph to be drawing, except if you look at some other crypto systems, you see that those are actually having a much bigger change in these exponents. Those really do have things like, say, n to the 1.4 down to n, or, I mean, they really do change the leading exponent. And that's something that's happened again and again for lots of other crypto systems. For instance, the red graph here is for lattices, and that's something where if you rewind to 2010, then lattice security levels against the best attacks known at that point were 45% higher in asymptotic security level compared to today. And if you go back to the turn of the century, then the gap was more than any constant, which is what the infinity is doing on this graph. And of course, there's other crypto systems where you see even more severe changes. For example, Psyche, which I understand you're not going to have a talk about, even though it's formally still there, is something which lasted great from 2011 to 2022 and, well, then suddenly totally smashed. So security going down to zero on this scale. And that's something which, again, different crypto systems show up differently on this graph. The fact that MCLEIS has this constant line is something which makes us feel better about it than a system which has had its security being reduced. If you're thinking, how do you do risk analysis for a crypto system? Then obviously you want people studying the crypto system. But there's more that you can take account of and that you should take account of if you're trying to avoid disasters that we've seen. Like, are the security levels going down and down and down, like happened for instance, low characteristic multiplicative group discrete logs, and then suddenly those were smashed. And then, okay, even if something seems stable for a while, how long is it stable? That's something which matters for the risk analysis. And something like Psyche lasting for 11 years with looked stable and then suddenly getting smashed, that's an example of, well, you need more time to find the best attacks. And, well, the longer you spent without finding better attacks, the lower your risks are. All right, so that's this asymptotic graph. But, well, this is what Section 3.4 of the Security Guide is about. And it's only the start of the story. The next section of the Security Guide, Section 3.5, says, look, when you're looking at these asymptotics, like n squared down to n, or n log n, or maybe it's n times log to the fifth n, or n divided by a million, you don't see that in the graph. And that can be a pretty significant change in your security level. So what we actually care about is for the particular parameters that users are going to be using, we want to know what are the security levels of those parameters. And the asymptotics, I mean, it's easy to compute asymptotics, well, easier than doing a concrete analysis, but it's not the complete story. So Section 3.5 is saying you really have to look at more details for the parameters that you want users to consider. And, well, okay, so Section 3.5 looks at what's there. This was written, I mean, the security guide that I'm talking about, document from 2022. And at that point, there were definitely lots of analyses of McLeese attacks. But this is something where I think important update is we're in a much happier situation now, understanding what the security levels are. This is something I tried to review in a talk about a year ago, what was going on here and how you can, without looking at the asymptotic graph, try to understand how stable McLeese is. And there's two metrics, one of which I think has some interesting features, but is not as good as the second one. But let me do the first one first. So this first metric that's not asymptotic is saying, try out some attack software. There was a paper, for example, at Eurocrypt 2022, where in the title it was saying it broke some challenges, like it had attack software breaking the McLeese 1284 challenge, which is one of a series of challenges to see, okay, how fast can you break various sizes of McLeese? And, well, some of us from the classic McLeese team tried going back to some software we had from 2008, and trying it on the same challenges on the computer chosen in the Eurocrypt 2022 paper, some AMD EPYC 7742s, and it turned out to be the same speed. So really no speed up in the software from 2008 to 2022. Fun thing to try. Try taking some current Lattice attack software, like JCK, G6K, and try running that on some challenges. And then try going back to 2008, where the state-of-the-art software was NTL, and then try that on the same challenges. I mean, you use the same machine, like you know, pick a CPU, tell G6K, JCK to use that CPU, and then run NTL on that CPU, and see what performance difference you get there. It depends on which size of Lattice problem you're trying out and various parameters, but it's fun experiment to try, and very different results from McLeese. Another metric I think fixes an important problem with the looking at challenges like this. I mean, one of the distractions of challenges, even though it's fun to look at, fun to compare the software speeds, when you look at challenges, you keep getting distracted by, well, how big are the computers we have? Like, I mean, after trying the software, seeing it was the same speed, we just pulled together some more computers and then broke the next challenge. And that's not saying anything about the software getting faster. It's just we ran the software on more computers. And then another team tried some GPUs, and then they broke the next challenge. Okay, so, I mean, slowly working up through seeing how big your computers are that academics can pull together. But that doesn't say anything about the algorithmic stability. Of course, we do have to think how big are the computers that attackers might have now and in the foreseeable future. But it's not saying anything about the algorithms getting better. Another issue with challenges is that when you say, oh, we're going to try out software on certain sizes and see how fast the software is, then, well, what is that saying about cryptographic security levels? It's not so clear because different algorithms scale in different ways. And then if you try to sort of estimate that scaling, it gets very complicated because the definition of software speed, that takes a while to understand. It's pretty complicated what a CPU is doing and all the layers in understanding software speed. I mean, just defining the speed of a typical CPU is it takes hundreds of pages to do that. And then, I mean, it's something you can learn, but it's not easy to extrapolate that to what's going to happen for something bigger. So the second bullet item is saying, all right, let's focus on something that the attacker has to do. Until they have a quantum computer, they have to be using bit operations. And so let's count bit operations, and let's do this in a way that we can be sure about our results. So this is Crypt Attack Tester, which appeared from some team members at Crypto last month. And what this is doing is three major pieces. So first of all, for AES and information set decoding, which is the main one-wayness attack against McLeese, it is going through various attacks and saying, all right, we're going to build complete circuits. Those are included in Crypt Attack Tester for various attacks. And when I say circuits, this is down to the level of bit operations. There's a clear definition of you can do any operation that's producing an output bit given at most two input bits. And okay, so it's like AND, OR, XOR, NAND. You can make the complete list. And then on top of that, this is building complete attacks, like simple AES brute force search or more complicated various ISD attacks. And then second part of Crypt Attack Tester is predicting the cost and the success probability of these attacks. So for each attack, there's software that builds a circuit, and there's software that predicts what the cost and success probability is going to be of that circuit. And so it's doing a computation, some formulas for here's the predicted cost, predicted probability. And Crypt Attack Tester actually, for a whole range of small sizes, it runs attacks and checks. Like it actually runs, simulates the circuits and says, does that match what the cost and probability estimates are? And okay, then when those match, you feel, I mean, of course, for probability, you're doing it experimentally, but yeah, I mean, if it's reasonably close, you feel like, yeah, good. And then the only thing that can go wrong here is if there's some extrapolation error which is invisible for the small sizes where the tests have run, where the attacks have been checked against the predictions. And okay, we hope that when we're trying, you know, two to the this number of bit operations, then it's not going to be something where we're missing some big error. This will catch all sorts of errors that we've seen in the literature are caught by doing this. Again, it's not a complete proof. It's the highest assurance we have is doing these tests on all sorts of small sizes, and the only risk that's left is that there's some extrapolation error which really is not visible in the small tests. And that's much better than just saying, well, you know, we've got software where we don't really have a complete model of the speed, don't really know what's going on there. I mean, Crypt Attack Tester is using a clear model of bit operations and focusing on really checking what's going on in that model. And again, attackers need to use bit operations until they have a quantum computer. Numerically, Crypt Attack Tester says for 348864, which is the smallest proposed McLeese parameter set, it says that if you take Stern's algorithm basically from 1988, so that's labeled as ISD1 inside Crypt Attack Tester, then that takes 2 to the 156.96 bit operations for that parameter set. And if you take the latest attacks like BGMM from 2012 or so, then that takes 2 to the 150.59 bit operations. And both of these, of course, all the subroutines, lots of effort to really minimize the bit operations for that. And if anybody has anything they can do better, then it will work in the same framework. Again, this is not just some ad hoc code-based thing. It can also handle AES and predict bit operations for that. It does predict bit operations for that. And okay, so this is giving us, compared to what was in the security guide from a couple years ago, okay, it's not doing quantum computation, so I'm not allowed to call it a quantum leap, but it really is putting our analyses of attack costs on a much more solid footing. We really have this feeling of, yeah, if there were something missing, which often happened in the literature from analyzing the number of gates you're using, then that would be caught by the test the crypt attack tester is doing. Again, it's not a proof, but it is high assurance. All right. So what does this say for stability of MCLEIS? It's like a 4% difference in security levels. Asymptotically, 0%. For these concrete sizes, it's a 4% difference, which is something. But again, a fun experiment to try is figure out what sort of change there's been for lattices, where because there's a lot of uncertainty in the exact costs of lattice attacks, there's actually like a 20% uncertainty interval for a typical lattice estimate. But if you look over enough years, then you can see, oh yeah, things have changed by much more than that. I mean, here it's a 4% for MCLEIS, it's a 4% change for 30 years of attack development. For lattices, it's much, much more than that. All right. One particular aspect of the security analysis is something which we've often gotten questions about, namely, why is the ciphertext size so small? And the reason that's a question about the security is if you say, okay, suppose I have a particular size I'm allowed for the ciphertext, then what security level can you achieve within that ciphertext size limit? So the question is, what's the trade-off between ciphertext size and security level? And people ask, you know, isn't it kind of weird that your ciphertext size is so small? And I mean, something's wrong there. Does this mean nobody's actually looked at the security of classic MCLEIS? It would be like somebody comes along with some super efficient crypto system and then clearly nobody's looked at it, right? Well, typically we answer this by saying, look, here's all this literature which is looking, and if you compare that to what's happening with lattices, then MCLEIS is looking better and better compared to lattices as the attack development happens. I mean, MCLEIS is very stable, and, well, lattices are not. But that's maybe not getting at the mathematics of what's going on inside classic MCLEIS versus lattices. And I think this is something else I gave a talk about recently, where I want to briefly outline what the mathematical answer is to this. So the first part is saying, it's well known that code-based crypto and lattice-based crypto have analogies, but there's more than just an analogy. It's very helpful if you want to compare attacks. It's very helpful to put things in the same framework, and that's something you can do. If you want to attack a MCLEIS ciphertext, then just like attacking a lattice ciphertext, you can translate that into finding a lattice vector which is close to a target point. Straightforward, standard mathematical transformation. So you get out of the code world and translate everything into lattices. View MCLEIS as a lattice system. Easy to do. When you've done that, then, okay, you apply, well, lattice attacks and say, how good are those attacks? And that's something which depends critically on how far your target point is from your lattice. And well, how far is it? That's something which depends on the points that you set up in your crypto system design, which depends on the decoding power of your decryption and then eventually your decapsulation. And if you quantitatively compare how far are your vectors from the lattice in MCLEIS versus how far are they in Kyber, Entru, whichever lattice system you're thinking of, then, well, MCLEIS is making vectors which are almost as far from the lattice as just random vectors in space. There's only like a polylogarithmic gap there. Square root of log, to be a little more precise. Versus if you do this for lattices, then it's a polynomial gap. And that's something which is much, much bigger. In other words, the lattice vectors are much closer to the target points are much closer to the lattice for lattice systems like Kyber and Entru than for MCLEIS. And this is something which translates directly into how well the attacks work, because when you have vectors that are much farther from the lattice, then it's harder for the attacks to find them. If you try lattice attacks, again, you can view code attacks as lattice attacks. If you try lattice attacks against these different systems, you immediately see how the distance from the lattice is showing up here. And this is something which, again, it boils down to the fact that MCLEIS is creating vectors that are farther from the lattice because MCLEIS has a quantitatively better decoder than Kyber, Entru, and so on. And so that's where the difference in ciphertext size is coming from. It's not some lack of study. It's there's a better decoder happening inside MCLEIS compared to Kyber, etc. All right. Another way that you can try to attack one-wayness is to try to recover the secret key or something equivalent to the secret key, the private key. And that's something where there's lots of papers for many years trying to do that, saying, well, you could try doing this. Yeah, it's very slow. You could try doing that. It's very slow. We can speed this up a bit, but it's very slow. You can write down some parameter sets for the McLie system, which are kind of extreme parameter sets where that makes the key recovery mechanisms look better than information set decoding. But for our selected parameter sets, we're very far away from any danger zone like that. These attacks that recover keys are much, much slower than information set decoding. You'd need drastic improvements in how fast the attacks are before they're anywhere near the ISD performance. Now, lots of crypto systems say, well, we prefer to have two problems being the same, namely key recovery and message recovery. And what I just said about, well, key recovery seems really hard for McLies, logically, that means the key recovery problem is different from the message recovery problem because, I mean, we're choosing parameters where the key sizes are at most a megabyte, for example, and then, okay, we work out the cost of message recovery and it's, well, never going to be able to do it, and we work out the cost of key recovery and it's like beyond the universe is ever going to be able to do anything like that. And those are on very different scales, which is only possible because those are two different problems. Now, when people say, oh, I've got a crypto system where those are the same problem, key recovery and message recovery, that sounds attractive in that you only have one problem to study instead of two. That's good, but it's a two-edged sword because it means that your key recovery problem is as weak as your message recovery problem. And this, if you look at typical crypto system that's talking about this feature, then yeah, the key recovery problem really is weak. And actually, usually the problems are slightly different, so you still have to work somewhat to see the problems. And typically the key recovery problem is clearly the best thing to attack. Kyber, for example, you definitely want to attack the keys rather than attacking the messages. For McLies, it's really the keys are very, very safe and the messages are just very safe, which is different from very, very safe. So it's different situation. It is two different problems, but that means that the key recovery can be much, much stronger. Now, there's also, for McLies, various papers which are saying, okay, we're really having trouble recovering private keys. Let's see, can we even distinguish public keys from random matrices? And that's something which, I mean, obviously, if you can't do that, then you can't recover the private keys, because if you could recover the private keys, then you could distinguish you could recompute the public key and distinguish that from a random matrix. And the private keys are much shorter than the public keys. Now, these papers on distinguishers, again, you can write down extreme parameter sets where they'll be faster than ISD, but for our selected parameter sets, they're slower. And it's just distinguishers. It's not actually doing a key recovery attack or any other one-wayness attack. So this is two steps away from anything that we're worried about. Of course, we track everything, want to make sure that any possible risk on the horizon, we pay attention to, see what's going on, and make sure we're safe. But, well, this is what's going on with key recovery and for distinguishers, and we're fine on both of these. All right, there's more ways that security is something that can fail in the real world and that we've paid attention to from the beginning. So let me talk about software. This is, of course, a major way that public key crypto fails, is that the software has some problems. Even when the specification doesn't have problems, the software does. What we're doing, we have, first of all, some software designed for deployment. That's the official C software for Classic McLies, which is coming from originally Tony, so team member who's also showing up on some previous slides, has this McBits Revisited paper, it has 2017. And that is the core of the official Classic McLies software. The things that are different are, well, okay, there's more parameter sets. So the original software was more limited, but all of our proposed parameter sets are covered by the official software. There's been various speed ups. So, I mean, already the 2017 paper had all sorts of speed ups, and there's been more and more speed ups since then. I'm not going to try to show you a table of all the speed ups. I mean, it's just a bunch of numbers. If somebody's interested, then send email can show you the tracking of all that. But anyway, things are getting faster. And then there's very small changes from, so McBits was predating classic McLees, and things like the private key format are a little different, and that's slightly changed the software, a few lines here and there. All right, there's another implementation of the specification. So this is something that we did, namely convert the specification into a Sage package. So script for all of the functions all the way through the complete crypto system. And this is something which is not supposed to be deployed. It's not constant time, for example, and it's very slow. The point of this is to maximize readability. And it's something where it has all these comments which are like, this is this line of the specification, this is this line of the specification, and you can just track through and check everything. And this Sage package, you can compute known answer tests from that, and we've done this, and it's not so slow that you can't do that. It's fast enough that you can run it on the computer, and it produces known answer tests, known answer results, which are exactly matching the official C software. So that gives us a feeling of we've got to double check. Like there's the specification translated to the C software, also translated to the Sage package, and then those are computer tested against each other. Okay, so that's the first thing we're doing to make sure that the software is correct. Now, inside these implementations, there's various software engineering principles for how do you make sure that things are properly checked and reduce the risk of error. One of the things we have is lots of people have been checking the specification and saying, okay, you know, going through every line and discussing, all right, what does this mean? What does this mean? Yeah, we're clear about this, etc. And every single function, every step in the specified functions has been implemented at least twice, often more than that, with all the implementations checked against each other. For example, the Sage versus the C software. Almost all cases, those implementations were done by at least two different people. There's one exception to that, namely, there's one subroutine for computing control bits. Now, I want to take a moment to talk about this and say what assurance mechanisms we have for that part. So, computing control bits, there's, first of all, the software is using formulas which are checked by one of these computer proof systems, which is checking every step of the proof. So that there's a proof that says the formulas work for every possible input. And also the output of the control bits computation is checked on every run by much simpler code. Now, what is that much simpler code doing? That's what the picture is in the bottom right of the slide. The green picture has eight items coming in at the top. These are eight elements which are going to be permuted, and they come out at the bottom as eight elements in some order. And what's happening is, well, the first two elements, the X, the butterfly at the top left, is either swapping or not, the first two elements. And that's controlled by a control bit. There's a bit saying, do you swap positions 0 and 1 in the array? And then there's a bit saying, do you swap positions 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7? And that's the first layer, the first four X's, first four butterflies in the picture. And then the next layer does the same thing with four more bits at distance 2. And then next layer, distance 4, distance 2, distance 1, that's it. And this is very simple to implement. This is something that's the much simpler code. Is code which is taking control bits and computing a permutation. Now, control bits computation, which is being checked by that, that is taking a permutation and working backwards to control bits, which is not such an easy algorithm. And that's the part where we have the computer checked proofs, and it's again double checked on the fly by the simply recomputing the permutation and see if it matches. All right. We have some more verification. The whole mathematical part of decoding, which is the mathematics inside decryption, which is the main mathematics inside decapsulation, those formulas now have computer checked proofs. Again, works for every possible input that you put in. Something surprising coming out of going through that proof process was discovering that actually the re-encryption step that we have in the software is something that can be eliminated with zero changes to the output. It's something which never makes any difference. The decoding algorithm is already what's called rigid. And so that means that, okay, you can just get rid of that part of the software, same results. Now, we're keeping that part of the software. One reason is that when I say computer check proofs of formulas, that's not necessarily the same as what the software is doing. There's something else. We want to have computer check proofs of everything. And we will soon have computer check proofs of the software. But right now, that's not the situation. Just in case there's some issue there and some bug in the decoding algorithm, having the re-encryption step is something which will save the day. Okay, so, I mean, looking farther ahead, once we have everything in the software verified, then maybe get rid of the re-encryption at that point. Although, if you have hardware which has faults, then maybe it's still good to keep the re-encryption step. All right, another thing where we have verification is for some of the C functions for doing root finding and other parts of the arithmetic. Those are verified with symbolic execution against CRYPTOL specifications. And that's, again, something that says that all inputs are handled correctly for those functions. And we also, another big subroutine is simply sorting an array, and that's something which also has computer verification by symbolic execution of the compiled software for doing that. Now, this is not everything. Again, when formulas are checked, there's still another step to verify the software. We also have to verify the linear algebra software. How could we mess up linear algebra? Well, look, just check everything, and then you feel like, all right, computer has verified everything. You feel better about there's just really reducing the risks there to zero for the software. Okay, but this is where we are now, and it's clearly coming together. We're very close to having the software fully verified and very comfortable situation to be in. Now, I've been mentioning that there's options like, are we doing re-encryption inside the computations? And there's other options. There's other possible decoding algorithms where, looking farther ahead, you could imagine maybe some of those others end up with proofs of everything and feeling very comfortable about those. And should implementers be allowed to do that? We have a specification, which is the classic McLeish specification, saying, well, okay, here's what you're supposed to do to be saying that you're doing classic McLeish. But what's the right thing to include in that specification? How much freedom should there be for implementers? Well, there's some guidance on this from various standardization organizations. For example, ISO has a performance principle, which says that whenever you can, you express your requirements in terms of what you're accomplishing, what you're performing, instead of saying how you're doing it, like what materials you're using, what your algorithm is doing. And this is something which means that the implementer has choices in what to do. You focus on what you're accomplishing for the end user. And then there's a similar guide from IEEE on how do you develop system requirement specifications. They say that your requirements should be independent of what your implementation is doing. If you want to have implementation guidance, they say you should put that in a separate document. And okay, there's more advice like this from various agencies and organizations. And well, that's what we've done. We thought very carefully about what should be in the specification. And the conclusion was the specification should say, here are exactly the functions that you need to compute, starting from whatever inputs and whatever randomness. When you're doing security analysis, not just interoperability, but if you want to prevent attacks like Rocca, then you have to pay attention to how randomness is used. So in order to enable security analysis of the full computations to apply to implementations, we require in the specifications for this input, for this randomness, you must compute the following output. That's what the specification says. It doesn't constrain how you do that computation. So if you have something else that produces exactly the same result from each input, each choice of randomness, then that's fine. The specification says here's the functions you have to compute. For further guidance of how you do the computations, like depending if you want something simple, something fast, or how do you protect against timing attacks, there's lots more things implementers are interested in, and that's where we have a separate guide for implementers. That's not part of the specification. The specification is saying, here's the functions to compute. One of the things I mentioned of implementers caring about is timing attacks. And this is something which is, there's lots of details to get this right. And this is something where, I mean, already from the beginning, we've been paying very close attention to this, avoiding data-dependent branches, data-dependent array indices. And this is something which is now computer-checked by TimeCop2, which is built into the SuperCop framework. Okay, these are major sources of timing attacks, and that's something that we've always said, yeah, we're dealing with that. Now, there's more things happening with timing attacks these days against post-quantum crypto. One of those things is some software getting in trouble with divisions. Now, divisions in your source code might turn into divisions in your compiled code, division instructions, or they might turn into multiplications if you're dividing by a constant. And well, it depends on your compiler, depends on your environment. Division instructions are typically variable time, and well, sometimes you can exploit that, as Kyber slash 1 and Kyber slash 2 have been demonstrated exploitable. There's also some CPUs where the multiplications take variable time. And okay, you have to watch out for not just branches and array indices, but all of the instructions that can take variable time. Another big issue for post-quantum timing attacks right now is compilers introducing variable time code where your source code looks constant time. But I mean, this is something Kyber's mentioned in the bullet item here, but I have to say this one is not Kyber's fault. I mean, it's clearly the compiler's fault for taking perfectly reasonable code and turning that into variable time code. But the compiler writers say, oh, we're not making any guarantees about timing. So, well, okay, I have to do something in the cryptographic software. Now, for MacLise, I mean, the MacLise computations don't need divisions. I mean, MacLise, we're working with bit vectors. Sometimes they're polynomials with bit coefficients, or sometimes just vectors. But the point is, it's bit vector operations. Those are the computations you end up doing inside MacLise. And so this is something which very naturally fits with just very simple instructions on the CPU. Also, it's good for hardware, of course. But I mean, worrying about the constant time software, this is naturally easy to do for MacLise. And for dealing with the possibility of compilers producing problems, libMacLise, which I'll also mention in the list of software in a moment, this includes TimeCop as something with the compiled library. Like every time you compile libMacLise, it's also compiling tests, which are something you run on your whatever target platform, and those tests will check, does your compiled library have any timing variations introduced by the compiler? So this is something which is giving maximum assurance that, yeah, we're fine. We're not going to run into any of these timing attack problems for MacLise. I said I was going to say some things about some software that's out there. I've been talking about the official software and then briefly mentioned libMacLise. And well, there's actually a bunch of different software implementations, some from team members and some from the broader community, which I think this is something which illustrates the level of interest from the community, except for, well, maybe the third item in the list, PQClean, libOQS. They're basically just saying, yeah, anything in round four, they'll include. I'm not sure if they've gotten rid of psych yet, but they say, I mean, that's not an endorsement of MacLise in any way. But various other things here, like, I mean, when people are taking the official software and providing wrappers for languages like Node, or they're translating it into Rust, Java, C Sharp, Botan apparently is another one not listed here, which is working on getting classic MacLise integrated. They've got another translation of the official software. And so this is showing interest. It's showing lots of different environments where we fit, and there's lots of libraries that people can just go ahead and use. libMacLise is taking the official software and putting some things around it that make it easy to integrate. For example, Debian and Ubuntu currently have it already integrated. Okay, there's various other examples. Could talk more about what these are accomplishing, but these are all beyond the official software examples of the libraries and things you can use today in different environments. This has also been pushed into various applications. Like some of these are using the Rust software, for example. Some of these are using the official software. I mean, people are taking the software that's available and actually rolling it out for various things. Some of these have been mentioned on the mailing list. Molvad in the middle there, they've actually just made another announcement that they're rolling out post-quantum support for smartphones. Now, it sounds like it's still, you have to push a button to enable it. But if you push that button and you're using Molvad, then you get your VPNs to Molvad with post-quantum support on whichever smartphones. Rosenpass, I'll say more about in a bit. Smoke is something which there's various secure messaging systems which are using MacLise, even sometimes before classic MacLise was proposed. And they're using like the original MacLise system. And well, we recommend, of course, upgrading to classic MacLise, but it's just another example of MacLise deployment that's out there. All of the examples on this list, except for Smoke, are using classic MacLise. Now, I think I should have some time left. Yeah, I have a little bit of time left. And there's one thing which I haven't been talking about, namely the megabyte public keys, where sometimes people exaggerate the impact here and say, oh, a megabyte, that'll never be used. There's no way you can roll that out in applications. It's you know, impossible to communicate a megabyte of data. And I mean, of course, the idea that nobody's ever using McLeese is contradicted by we have applications using it already. But okay, beyond the exaggerations there, there's a legitimate question of, can't we do better in terms of efficiency than a megabyte for the public keys? Shouldn't we be using lattices? Isn't it better for the environment? Aren't we getting better efficiency if we have much smaller keys? And, well, okay, let me discuss that. So first, the situation there where, yeah, you definitely get better performance is a situation of one-time keys. If we look, for instance, at NIST SP-857, then it says that for a public ephemeral key agreement key, the crypto period, the time you're supposed to be using that, is one key exchange. As soon as you've generated a shared secret, you throw that key away. So what's the cost here? Well, Alice generates a public key and does a computation, sends that to Bob, however many bytes that is, and then Bob encapsulates to that key, sends the ciphertext back, and then Alice decapsulates. So that's the cost. Key gen plus public key bytes plus encap plus ciphertext bytes plus the decap. When you total up the cost of this using some reasonable estimates for the costs of servers and internet communication that's available today, then you see that McLeese at our recommended high security level is costing about 2 to the -$20 for one ephemeral one-time key exchange. Whereas a lattice system is going to typically cost only about 2 to the -$28. So definitely cheaper to use lattices. But that's not the end of the story, because if you keep reading SV800-57, you see a bunch more types of public keys. Public signature verification keys, public authentication keys, key transport keys, static key agreement keys, authorization keys. And each of these you're allowed to use again and again and again. You can have your computer using these keys any number of times, even for a year, that is, or even longer, that's completely compliant with 800-57. So what should we be doing as a community to handle these types of keys? I want to emphasize that in this list, there's different possibilities. Some of these are signatures, some of them are chems, and let me just go through this for a moment. Of course, a public signature verification key, that's using signatures. Of course, a key transport key or a static key agreement key, those you're going to use chems. But there's an interesting intermediate case, which is a public authentication key or a public authorization key, and this you get to choose between signatures and chems. You can use either one, and in post-quantum crypto, chems are going to give you better performance. I think maybe in the interest of time, I'll skip the credits here, but it is well known for a long time that you have this choice for public key authentication of a message or authorization. This is something you can build from signatures or from encryption very easily. And from chems, you can build very easily. Now, you might be thinking, well, wait a minute. All these different types of keys, that's not actually what the post-quantum competition is about, right? Because, I mean, we're talking about TLS. You know, there's ephemeral, there's these one-time keys and there's signatures, and that's it. But no, the call for proposals said, NIST intends to standardize post-quantum alternatives to its standards for digital signatures and key establishment, like 800-56A, which are used in a bunch of protocols, not just TLS. The importance of public key size varies depending on the application. And if you look at 800-56A, which is supposed to be replaced by this, you see multiple possibilities for your Diffie-Hellman key exchange. Static-static, non-interactive, okay, there's no submissions handling that. But static ephemeral Diffie-Hellman, which is specifically considered and specified in 800-56A, that is the equivalent of a chem with a static public key, which it was, again, one of the possibilities in 800-57 as well. Ephemeral, that's like using a chem with an ephemeral public key. I mean, you can view Diffie-Hellman as a chem, and then it's exactly this translation. This is not just some abstract possibility in these standards. This is something used all the time in reality. For example, Microsoft's encrypting file system, EFS, different security layer from BitLocker. The quote here is from Microsoft saying, BitLocker is your single user encryption of your whole drive. EFS is multi-user encryption. It's using public key crypto, encrypting a file to the public key of the user who is authorized to read that file. And then after that, the system's not able to read it anymore, except for that user's able to decrypt it. Another example, email encryption. Lots of possibilities, lots of standards, but very common use is you have users' public keys statically in a database on your disk, and you've downloaded those public keys, and you encrypt messages to those public keys. Again, static public keys. There's also signature keys, which can be converted into chem keys. Maybe in the interest of time, I'll skip this. And there's also server keys, which really do seem like they have to be signature keys, like certificate authority keys. But there's definitely lots of cases where people are using static public encryption keys, and there's more cases where people who are using signatures now would gain speed by using chem keys instead of signature keys for post-quantum crypto. This has a really important difference, it makes a really important change in the efficiency analysis, because if Alice is receiving, say, 2 to the 15 ciphertext from Bob, Alice is sending the public key to Bob only once, and then Bob is doing 2 to the 15 encapsulations plus the ciphertext bytes plus then Alice does the decapsulations for each of those. And this really changes the balance of costs. It means that if you take a lattice system for 2 to the 15 ciphertext, it is more expensive than doing McLeese. So if you simply switch over to considering static public keys for encryption, then you see that McLeese is not just lower risk than lattices, it is the most efficient choice. This is something where I again want to emphasize, this is not just some possibilities out there, this is already in NIST standards, like 800-57, and it's even in 800-56, which this project is supposed to be upgrading to post-quantum crypto. So it's not just that we have one-time encryption keys and static signature keys, there's also in the standards and in the real world, there's static encryption keys, and McLeese is the most efficient choice for those. I'll skip this parenthetical note. I have an example here, which is the same as an example that Eduardo gave at the 5th PQC standardization conference, which is the Rosenpass VPN. And this is something which is using two different chems for the situations where they are the most efficient options available. For static keys, for long-term keys, this is using McLeese. And that's something which is encrypting the data, it's authenticating the server, and that's something where the people have the public keys sitting on their disks all the time. It's not something which is communicated frequently. The ciphertexts are being communicated all the time. For forward secrecy with one-time keys, Rosenpass is using Kyber. And that's something where, okay, if an attacker steals the hardware, then you want forward secrecy, so Kyber is playing a role in the security there. But, well, if Kyber gets broken and an attacker does not steal the hardware, you still have classic McLeese providing your confidentiality and integrity for all your data. If you tried to say, oh, we should use Kyber for both parts of this, that would damage efficiency. Because, again, the Kyber ciphertexts are much bigger than the classic McLeese ciphertexts. All right, summary table for the different key types in 800-57. There are some types of keys, like ephemeral key agreement keys, so the equivalent of ephemeral Diffie-Hellman from 800-56A, that's where the most efficient choice is lattices. But if you have a public key transport key or a public static key agreement key, that's like static ephemeral in 800-56A, and then the most efficient choice, not just the safest choice, is classic McLeese. Similarly, for authentication and authorization, you can use signatures, but chems are the most efficient choice. Classic McLeese is the most efficient choice. And of course, there's also applications using signatures, and then, well, use signatures, whatever is the most efficient there, which you're also working on. If you care about efficiency, you have to recognize all these different scenarios, not just leave out the middle two. Last slide, recommendations. We, the Classic McLeese team, recommend recognizing, just like in 800-56A, just like in 800-57, that some public encryption keys are static. And this is something which many applications are relying on. So this does not take any effort to recognize. It's simply saying, yeah, it's out there, it's already in the standards, and let's just figure out what to do with that post-quantum. And then independently of, I mean, I know you've been talking about, yeah, there should be a backup for lattices of have bike or HQC, but separately from that track, whatever's happening for one-time encryption keys, if you want to handle static public encryption keys, which again are within scope, classic McLeese is not just the lowest risk option, it's also for that the most efficient option. And finally, little parenthetical note, we have more recommendations, which if I had more time, I would go through, but I think this is good enough for the talk. Thank you for your attention.